why I opened and closed the book the way I did, which is with the factory workers at the Topps factory. And I thought it was important to kind of zoom out and remind people that, the heart of baseball is really not even the players. It's the bigger effect and the bigger community. And this is one of the take-home points of the book is that, it's the players themselves, what they miss more is not anything to do with baseball. It's their teammates, it's their camaraderie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, back from a break, and this time I brought a book report. Author, professor, baseball card aficionado Brad Baluchian has written a book that's part memoir, part travel log, and part baseball book, all wrapped up neat and tidy in that familiar Topps baseball card wax pack, complete with a stick of gum. The Wax Pack by Brad Baluchian. 15 picture cards, one stick of gum. On the road in search of baseball's afterlife. The concept of the book is so genius, I'm jealous. Baluchian opened a pack of 1986 Topps and then set out on the road to meet each of the players and not just tell their story, but during their baseball career or about their baseball career. Ask them where they've gone since their baseball career. Talk to them about life after baseball, life after being in a wax pack. He went to Los Angeles to see Steve Yeager, Gary Templeton in San Diego, tracked down Don Carmen in Naples, Florida, and found Vince Coleman in, well, we'll get to that. Baluchian was kind enough to join me to talk about his new book, the revelations it has for Cardinal fans about Gary Templeton, and the stories baseball cards help us tell. But first, about our sponsor. Imagine your home totally organized. Closet by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design. Call 314-733-9855. That's Closets by Design. 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, the official sponsor of your weekly best podcast in baseball. Now here's author Brad Baluchian as we open the Wax Pack. Take me to the moment when you have not yet opened the Wax Pack and are about to consider this one for the book. Like, what's that moment of anxiety, anticipation, elation, but somewhat nervousness?
Yeah, I think it recre I was able to recreate that. I mean, I guess not just the feeling, but sort of the feeling times 10 of what it was like as a kid to get packs. And I remember going down to the Greenville pharmacy in Rhode Island as a kid to buy a wax pack. And, you could only afford to get one, maybe two, and how thrilling it was just to have the reveal of each card as you shuffled through. So thinking about that and recreating that at the same time, knowing that, as you said, the guys in this pack are gonna I don't know if it was gonna occupy 6 years of my life, but yeah. I knew it was gonna occupy a substantial amount of my life for the future. So I admit I had certain biases and that I wanted to get guys that I really liked as a kid. And as I say in the book, my favorite players were the more the journeymen and the underdogs. So I was really hoping to get a lot of those guys. And of course, in any given pack, most of the guys are going to tend to be like that because just they're more common.
Right. And you were pretty candid in the book about how you opened up a few different packs and then settled on the one, but you kept the integrity of the pack.
That's right.
This was how it came. Is it also true that then throughout your entire road trip, as thousands of miles kind of added up, that you stuck with the one piece of gum, that it lasted that long?
No, I actually chewed the gum like the day that I opened the pack, and and it was an instant, just gross, and it dissolves. It kind of is really brittle and dissolves in your mouth, and I don't think you can't even really chew it. I think I just spat it out after a little while.
Yeah,
but no, that the gum did not last.
The gum did not last. No, and then you have to keep brushing your teeth just to feel like you get the sugar away from that kind of aged gum. How many packs did you end up kind of considering?
I had about a dozen packs, so I had to make sure that there were enough guys that were alive. That was one thing, and then making sure I always knew this was going to be a road trip book and like a travel book. Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to make sure that it would make for an interesting travel log in terms of the ground that I was covering.
So yeah, how did you kind of mesh that notion then? So it's kind of on the road with Tops. You wanted it to be a baseball book, a travel book, but then at some point in time, or maybe right from the get-go, did it also, when did you become comfortable with it being a memoir as well? Because you talk about rather personal things in here.
Right. And I mean, initially when just thinking about the concept of writing a book based on a pack, some of the initial thoughts were that maybe I'll do the story of the 86 season through the eyes of these different players in the pack. And The more I thought about it, the more I realized that it would be really hard to do that and not have it be disjointed. Like the only thing these guys had in common was that they played in that era and they were in the pack. They were from all these different teams and all that. So to make it, I always knew I wanted to do something that had a cohesive narrative that wasn't just like 14 individual chapters that are stapled together. And so the more I thought about that and developing a story arc and a narrative, the more I realized that the only way to really do that is for me to be a character in the story and to be a bridge between the players. And I had some of my friends that read the book or the early drafts or ideas of the book really, you know, encouraged me to stick to the vision of having myself be a big part of the book. And I'm glad that I got that advice because I was being pushed by a lot of people in the industry in publishing, agents and editors, to take myself out of it. And they were saying, well, you know, who cares about you? You know, we want to read about baseball players.
Yeah.
And so I it was at a kind of a risk for me to stick to my own vision. But I always believed that there had to be some connective tissue between these players. And I felt like my character could do that.
Yeah. I mean, just by the act of opening a pack, you become part of the story by definition. I mean, it is your pack that you're kind of relating to. So I get how it becomes personal. And did you worry at times that it would become quixotic then?
Well, I worried always that I would go too far to one side, right? Like the book, I always knew this was very ambitious because it was a mix of memoir and travel and baseball. And it's written in this narrative nonfiction style where I'm very much, you know, in the book as a character. And so I was always worried, okay, if I go too far to the memoir side, I'm going to alienate the baseball fans and lose them. If I go too far to the baseball side, I'm not going to have as broad appeal with people that may not be huge baseball fans. So I was always kind of trying to strike that balance.
What was it about the 86 Tops that captured your imagination in this? Is that your favorite design? Is that your most readily available? What was it about that particular year?
It was really that was the first year that I remember collecting cards as a kid. When I was 6 years old. So that made an easy choice because the other, you know, to go with the second year, the third year, wouldn't have seemed very notable, right. But I did happen to really like that set. I liked the big, you know, black banner and the big block colorful letters. Aesthetically, I liked it. I also liked it more than the 87, 88, 89, those sets.
As they became more and more mass produced as well.
Right.
Tell me about your baseball fandom. How much of your fondness for baseball do you connect to a fondness for baseball cards? Are they symbiotic, or did one fuel the other? Was one just a tag along? I mean, was the fondness for the game first, for playing the game first, or how did those two things meet and merge?
Well, the root of my interest really was my dad and my relationship with my father, and that's, you know, in the book. He was a big baseball fan, and from a very young age, that was the sport. I mean, that was the sport that he followed. And so he introduced me to baseball on TV and going to games. But I think it was the cards that drew me in initially. I mean, I don't remember exactly when I got my, or how I got my first cards, but I know that I remember that to me, the cards, there was so much information packed into those cards. And as someone that I just loved to read, I loved, facts and data and information. And so I just loved studying the backs of the cards and really getting to know the players. And I think the cards were really instrumental in building the foundation of my interest in baseball. And then the rest of it all kind of followed from there.
Two of the cards that happen in your pack and then are then featured as part of the Wax Packers in the book, The Wax Pack, is have Cardinal ties. First and foremost is Gary Templeton, who is probably well painted as the villain in one of the most pivotal moments in Cardinal history, to be candid. If there's not a Gary Templeton in a Cardinal uniform, then there's probably not an Ozzie Smith in a Cardinal uniform, and there's not a Hall of Fame shortstop who has called St. Louis home for a long time and been an ambassador of St. Louis. And then the other is Vince Coleman, who is a Cardinal Hall of Famer, and yet remained elusive for you. And I found it interesting, particularly in that chapter with Vince Coleman, and I do want to talk about Gary Templeton because your chapter on him was fascinating, but how Vince Coleman's elusiveness made maybe for a better story than had he been available for interview. Is that possible?
Have you ever interviewed Vince Coleman?
Oh, yes. I have talked to him several times. I've also had him stiff arm me multiple times. I called him once and he answered the phone along the lines of like, Uncle Al's auto body.
What?
And played it off as if, and I'm like, hi, Vince, this is Derek with the Post-Dispatch. And he goes, you've got the wrong number. How can I help your car? And I'm like, I do not have the wrong number. I've gone through this before. I know what's going on here. If you don't want to talk to me, just don't. I mean, it just was like this whole, it was like really trippy. And he continued it long enough, just to the point where I did go, like, had that moment of doubt that maybe I did dial the wrong number. And then he hung up on me.
What a great story.
Oh my gosh. I think he's done it to many people because he was such an expert at knowing when he had just gone far enough to get me teetering on doubt and then take it away from me.
In my research on him, my perception is that he always felt like the press was unfairly covering him and portraying him in an unfair light. But having read his body of work, it didn't seem that way to me. I mean, it seems like Vince's wounds were self-inflicted. And so I didn't expect him to be very cooperative, but I still, like I did with everyone, did everything I possibly could to try to talk to him. I didn't put this all in the book, but there was some backstory with trying to get a hold of him. I eventually did get a hold of him before the trip, and he just flat out said no, he wasn't going to talk to me. But I had gone through quite a lot to reach him, to the point of I went down to spring training when he was an instructor with the White Sox, and I had read in an article from Sports Illustrated in 1985 that he had made this comment about how he loved his Uncle Carter's sweet potato pies, and okay. So he was coming in before the game, an exhibition game. And I figured if I just yelled out his name, he wasn't going to come over. But I yelled out, Uncle Carter's sweet potato pies from the stands. And, of course, that's like the last thing he expects to hear, right? So it actually got his attention, and he walked over to me. And I had my moment. And I actually had a letter that I had where I had explained the whole premise of the book that I handed to him and said, hey, I'm hoping you will talk to me. And he wouldn't even take the letter. He just sort of looked at me and said, no, and walked away.
Wow.
So, in the end, I think the chapter worked. I think being able to go and, I mean, this is kind of the same case with the guys that didn't talk to me, that I was able to write around it and could tell some of their story. Or some of the story of that guy is them not talking to me, right? That's sort of part of the storyline. So being able to go to Jacksonville and find his childhood home and his church and his high school, that all made for really, I think, interesting reading and writing. And I knew that at the very least, I could do what I do, which is to go and describe the environment that I'm in and tell the story of the chase.
Right.
And I feel like that was, you know, I was able to pull that off.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that you did so well in the book, but, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but also kind of strived to do, was to tell the story of someone, sort of a life after baseball, by someone who's defined forever by being in baseball, regardless of what they do. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're a Major League Baseball player and you have a baseball card, you know, that's gonna be a lot of how people know you for the most part. And I thought the absence of Vince Coleman in the chapter spoke volumes about Vince Coleman when you looked at it through that lens of, here's a guy who, as fast as he was, you know, as much as he did in baseball and as much as he chased in baseball, not always successfully, he just hasn't yet caught up with life after baseball and maybe doesn't want to face it. And I thought that was very fascinating part of that chapter.
Right. And I like the imagery of him running, right? Because, yeah. I mean, I kind of opened the chapter with that notion that he's always running, and it speaks a lot about, I think, who Vince is and what he's missing, that he's never seems satisfied, never seems comfortable really in his own skin, always, you know, trying to chase something that he's never actually going to catch.
Right. Yeah. Or doesn't want to face.
Right. Or running away from something as well. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's one of the, I mean, if you want to kind of get intellectual or about it,
it's a podcast. We do what we can.
No, well, hey, I mean, I'm a professor, so it's what I do. But yeah, there's the book is about identity to some extent, right? The identity, we all have different masks that we wear and different identities. And certainly anyone who's been famous to the level that any Major League Baseball player is will always have the identity of a baseball player as part of them. But then the question is, you know, how do you transition into your other identities as a father, as a son, as a husband, as, you know, a friend, that are roles that are probably, you know, more important in the long run than the baseball part. And that's where a lot of these guys really succeeded. And then a lot of them failed, and a lot of them failed and then, you know, learned from their mistakes.
Yeah. I think that also is a powerful part of the Gary Templeton chapter, because how he's known in St. Louis, and the Gary Templeton, probably by like the casual fan or even the long-term Cardinal fan who knows him through his actions on the field and through the trade that followed. I think that chapter is going to be highly revelatory because it introduces a Gary Templeton that St. Louis probably should know more of, or certainly know more about. I know you did a lot of research going into each interview, like, you know, it paved the way for your trip with a lot of reporting and research before actually putting the key in the ignition. What were your expectations of talking with Templeton after reading about, you know, the incident on the field where obviously he had a lewd gesture, was yanked off the field, and then that became the trade to the Padres? What was your expectation? Kind of what was your knowledge of that before ever going to him?
Yeah, well, the two things that to the most fans they remember about Templeton are the incident in 1981 where, you know, he flips off the crowd and Whitey Herzog kind of yanks him, and then he gets suspended. And then that he says, if I ain't starting, I ain't departing about the All-Star.
Oh, right.
The All-Star. You know, which both of which are stories that are really not true, or the truth of the story has not been fully revealed. And that, you know, this in the latter, it was actually Jack Buck that paraphrased, you know, basically Templeton's attitude. And Buck said, so if you're saying, if you ain't starting, you ain't departing, you know, so it was actually Buck's words, not Templeton's words. Mm-hmm. And then on the Herzog incident, which is detailed in the book, I really wanted to, you know, I mean, when I met Templeton, yeah, I was I was expecting him to be more aloof and maybe even surly based on the reporting that had been done about him. I had never seen him described as particularly like chatty and charming, but that's how he was. I mean, right from the beginning, he was kind of goofy, actually. He was interesting because he would get, you know, he was really animated and really wanted to tell the Whitey story, and would get really worked up. But it wasn't like he was, I didn't see it as him like holding on to anger. It was just, that's just more how Gary Templeton is. Like, he can be really worked up about something, and in the next minute, he's just laughing. You know, he's just kind of that personality. So that kind of caught me off guard, how open he was, and also how kind of laid back and friendly and willing to talk about whatever. I didn't ever sense that he was holding anything back when he was talking to me.
Well, there's a very impressive, I'll give you a compliment, like, as just reporter to reporter, there is an impressive feat of reporting there, where you talk to him about a child that he mentioned early on,
right,
and then is not mentioned again, and you get some clarity about that. And I thought, you know, that was a very powerful part of that. In fact, that whole chapter, I thought, was just very revealing, not only for your depth and deft of reporting, if I can articulate that correctly, but also, you know, just how open he was when eventually just asked. Seemed like he, about the Herzog thing, about his background, about he was open to talk about it.
Yeah, and yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I really tried to, I went back and I read all the articles, because this was covered in the Washington Post and the New York Times, in addition to the St. Louis papers. And I kind of dissected it a little bit in the book, and showing that the way that it was covered by the reporters at the time, I felt left out certain things and was inaccurate in certain ways. So there was maybe some blame there, but also, more importantly, blame on Whitey Herzog and his teammates, who very clearly heard what was said. I mean, these fans that came down to the field level and were, you know, yelling the N-word at Templeton, which is what prompted his reaction, that was like really left out of all of the reporting. Well, and also it was left out of the, in terms of like the press conferences afterwards. The Herzog and his teammates didn't tell the reporters, oh yeah, also this is why he did that.
Right.
Which was a huge omission. And as a result, you know, Templeton is made out to be the bad guy and the villain. And then the whole part about that he goes to the psychiatric facility and he's in there, they're being evaluated. And his, you know, what he told me was, he's like, man, I was just in there playing ping pong for 3 days. But yet he had to then sort of follow the marching orders and say, go along with this diagnosis that he was depressed and chemical imbalance and all this and that. And, you know, he said that he flushed whatever medication they gave him down the toilet, because he didn't have a psychiatric disorder. He was just reacting to something that was horrible that was said to him.
How much of that did you know before talking to him? And how much was your conversation with him just like someone pulling the curtain back and seeing the machinations behind a well-told, you know, basically a story we all thought we knew?
Yeah, I mean, I knew what had, in detail, what had been reported. So as I included some of this in that scene, in that chapter, where, you know, at first he says like that he didn't see a doctor, and I had read in multiple accounts that the doctor definitely saw him. So I pushed him. I wanted to. This is where my first job in journalism was, as a fact checker, and so I'm grateful for that, because I, even at the risk of upsetting him and other people, I decided I'm going to fact check him right now in real time. And I said, you know, Gary, it says here in the article, it says that you spoke to a doctor. Is that a lie? Are they lying? I mean, I outright said to him, basically, are you calling these reporters liars? And that's when he pauses and he says, well, maybe I did see a doctor, but I didn't take the medication, whatever they gave me. And basically I didn't have a problem. So, you know, I think a lot of athletes, especially athletes from the past, they have their first of all, their memories are really flawed, They have their soundbite answers to certain things, but they're maybe not used to getting pushed or getting fact checked like that. And I was wanting to do that. I don't think there's anything wrong as a reporter in fact checking someone, as long as you are being honest about your motivation, that you're just trying to get the truth, that you're not trying to nail somebody. You're just trying to find out what happened.
Right. No, and I agree with that. I mean, time permitting, like, you know, that's one of the things, like, you know, I agree with you. Like, there's no harm, even if it gets somewhat caustic. There's no harm in holding somebody to the facts. And you're right about that. Like, it's interesting what, when you ask somebody about something in the past, you know, which we do a lot of in baseball, because we ask a lot about history and everything like that, how recollection tends to melt into legend, even for the players who were involved. Either they've told the story so many times, or they've heard the story so many times, that they start fortifying what might not be the entire story with their answers, or they're so guarded about it, like you said, that they lacquer it up with cliches that it's hard to know to get at the truth. And I found that chapter very fascinating, because you were able to maybe even drill down past the plaque of memory and get some truth.
Yeah, I think that's also where, I mean, we're having news, you know, daily beat writers and reporting is so important, having that archive to go back to. That's why contemporaneous reporting is so necessary. It's also why, you know, asking the right questions, whether you're doing a story based on the past or the present, is so important. And, you know, I feel like later, you know, one of the guys in the chat in the book is Don Carmen, who had that famous story about how he posted the list of cliched answers in his locker because he was so tired of giving the same cliche over and over again, about, you know, yeah, we're just here, you know, one take it one day at a time and give 110%. And it's interesting, Carmen pointed out that there's blame on the player's side for basically, you know, giving those same cliched answers, but there's also blame on the reporter side. If you don't ask good questions, the players are going to give you the cliched answers, right? And I think that part that's left out, that it's not just the players dodging, it's the reporters sometimes being lazy about what they're asking.
Yeah, in the business, we kind of refer to those as the talkabout questions. Like, right. I'm trying to think back through our conversation here to see if I have said any talkabout, but if you go to a player and say, talk about your home run, or talk about what you tried to do in that first, you know, that's not a question.
Right.
A commandment, which, hey, what are we doing here? And B, that invites cliche. Well, I was just giving my effort, you know, because they control. If you say talk about, you are ceding the reins of the conversation.
Well, you bring up a good, I mean, I wonder too, like, and it'd be interesting to do more pieces about the past where, as I feel like a lot of times in writing about old baseball stuff, like you said, it's sort of we just keep asking the same, asking players to recount certain things from their point of view. But if you really go back and you dissect sort of what was reported at the time and you kind of fact check it, it'd be interesting to see how they would react and maybe how much new material might come out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I agree. And, I like that excavation when I have an opportunity to do it. You know, and being around the Cardinals and covering the Cardinals has kind of helped that, because they do keep their greats close. And that's the interesting part about that Templeton, you know, when I'm reading it from that perspective. To me, you know, here's Gary Templeton, a really good player who could have had a long career with the Cardinals, you know, 100 hits from both sides of the plate, switch hitter. He fit in so many of the ways of what the Cardinals were built to do at that time. And yet he has this incident that you bring new light to, new clarity to. And also, we probably look on, to be candid, with modern eyes a lot differently, to be honest.
Oh, for sure.
And definitely a lot more aware, rightfully so, of his reaction. I mean, his reaction in today's game to that event caught on 12 iPhones in the same area and placed on TikTok and Snapchat and Facebook would be a lot different. Let's just put it that way. I mean, it would be tons different. But then you have this guy who's traded for Ozzie Smith, who becomes a Hall of Famer here, lives in St. Louis, and Templeton goes to San Diego and he calls San Diego home And I find the whole thing very fascinating. How did you leave your time with Gary Templeton? Did you have a new found perspective on him, appreciation for him?
Yeah, I mean, I thought, again, he was maybe one of the more pleasant surprises in terms of not what I expected in a very positive way. But I also, I didn't get the sense that he was dissatisfied with where he is now. I mean, I think, yeah, he still would like to be managing because he just loves baseball like so many of these guys. But he seemed like, you know, comfortable. He seems like a very self-assured guy. Like he's whatever injustices happen to him, he seems like he's pretty much at peace with it in general. Like he's not walking around carrying this weight every day. You know, if you ask him about it, like I did, you're going to get the emotion there. But I think San Diego was a good fit for him, you know, just more laid back. He really seems to love the people, the community. He clicked in San Diego. So even though it didn't work out well in St. Louis, I think he's actually grateful that he ended up in San Diego. He still lives there now.
A few of the cards that you had were of players that you would consider your favorite players, right? I mean, these were cards that you would have collected as a kid and put in, you know, the binder and kept protected, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, like Lee Mazzilli, I was always a fan of as a kid. Rance Mullenix. And then, of course, Don Carmen was my favorite player.
What was there any hesitation on your end? You know, the whole saying, you know, you don't ever want to meet your heroes. Was there ever any hesitation?
Well, definitely, because I briefly alluded to it in the book, but the first time I had tried to do this kind of thing was with the professional wrestler, the Iron Sheik.
Yeah.
Back in 2005, when, I mean, I quit my job at a magazine and moved to the suburb of Atlanta where he was living and spent a couple months working with him. And he was my favorite wrestler as a kid. So kind of in that same tradition of most kids, you know, didn't like the Iron Sheik because he was a bad guy. And I was always one to, you know, not follow the crowd. That ended up being such a disaster with, you know, meeting your hero. It was, I mean, surreal in the other direction where now here's my childhood hero and he's threatening to kill me in his living room. Yeah. So I was a little bit gun shy after that. I mean, I certainly didn't think that Don Carmen would be anything like that, but who knows? I mean, I didn't know. I had a pretty good idea he was going to be a good guy because in the preparation for the trip, he had been very attentive and very helpful in getting information. So, but he did tell me he was initially hesitant to talk to me because, I guess Scott Boras generally doesn't like his clients talking to the media. I mean, his employees talking to the media. But I think I was grateful that Carmen decided to give me a chance. And, of course, ended up being one of the best parts of the book.
Actually, we should tell people what Carmen does for Scott Boras. He's a mental skills coach in a lot of ways. And like one of the players that he has talked to, and you can offer greater detail to this, but was Matt Holliday when he was with the Cardinals. Matt Holliday would be in touch with him at times because, well, obviously Holliday was represented by Boras and Carmen works with a wide variety of players. And I don't want to oversimplify what he does, but he's there for them as a former player, but with this understanding of mental skills and different ideas in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some independence there, right? Because, you know, Carmen talks about how a player is much more reluctant to go see a team psychologist because that guy's working for the team. Whereas if it's Boras, you know, Boras is the player's agent. So there's no reporting back to the team on what's happening in the therapy sessions.
I would be remiss not to ask you what it's like to discuss and have a baseball book out at a time when people are expecting baseball and there is no baseball. What has this period been like for you with everybody basically in quarantine and the game at full stop?
Yeah, it's been difficult for all of us, I think. And it's kind of awkward to promote a book right now because in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem that important. At the same time, after working on it for 6 years, I want to, you know, I think it deserves to have the chance to get out there. So I mean, I had to cancel my book tour, which I would have been on right now, and hopefully down the line I can do that. But one nice thing has been to see a little community form around all of us in the same situation. So several baseball writers, we all were talking on social media, people that had books that were being affected by this, and we formed this Pandemic Baseball Book Club.
Oh, great. Eric
Nussbaum and Jason Turbo, Anika Orok, and we came together and said, hey, let's work cooperatively. And we're doing podcasts and interviews with each other to promote each other's books. And we're up to, I think, 18 writers now that are all part of this.
That's great.
So it's been a nice side effect of the whole thing.
Did you have, as you worked through a baseball book that was, like we talked about, part travelogue, a lot memoir, did you have some baseball book influences? Were they like your fondness for the game and your background mm-hmm. as a writer and obviously love of writing? What were some of the baseball book influences you had?
So when you write a book, you have to write a proposal first, and you have to write, like, what are the comparable titles, right? Mm-hmm. So they can get a sense. And so for me, I put down certainly Boys of Summer. I put down The Teammates, which when they're going to find Ted Williams. Stolen Season by David Lamb. These are some older
books. One of the best underrated baseball books.
I mean, there are baseball books that I think are fantastic, like Jason Turbo's books and MVP Machine, but those books are more like firmly about baseball mm-hmm. in terms of more of what I was trying to do. Things like Teammates and Stolen Season were more relevant. And then also outside of baseball, Killing Yourself to Live by Chuck Klosterman, where he goes around to find the grave sites of all these rock and roll musicians. And even Cheryl Strayed's book Wild about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail were books that I thought did a great job of blending the memoir with the topical content and the travel.
Which brings us back to the beginning of opening that first pack. Can you describe to me the lightning bolt of inspiration? You were at an Oakland A's game. Is that right? Am I remembering this correctly? And this kind of epiphany of doing this book came along.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, it was, I describe it, I guess, as kind of lightning bolt-ish, but it was a little more diffuse than that, in that I had for a while been thinking about how I could write about the guys that I grew up collecting. Mm-hmm. And sitting there in the Coliseum, and I did this a few different times. I mean, when there's baseball, I go and I sit in the upper deck and you can have the whole section to yourself. And I was just realizing that, I still love baseball, but I don't know the players like I did as a kid. I mean, I think having the baseball cards, you learn so much more about them.
Sure.
And I was kind of like a little bit sad that I didn't know the like, I looked at the opposing lineup and it's like, oh, okay, I know a few of those guys, but, and then it got me just thinking more about back to the guys that I did know as a kid and wondering what happened to them. And then the idea of just seeing a pack having 15 cards, it's just very practical, right? I mean, because it's the right number of cards for if you do one chapter per player, it just seemed conducive to a book. And so that was the kind of genesis of it. And then it became more, how am I going to logistically do this? But I thought, you know, also having that random, the spirit of the randomness was important, that like, if I handpicked 15 guys, it would be fun, but it just seems a little bit too contrived. Whereas the random part was exciting to me.
I want to use the word lightning bolt because basically I want to describe my jealousy for the idea, because that's what gets me about this. Is like, it's so well executed, and you know, I mean, the book is well done, and the reporting is so excellent, and the story that you tell from starting it off on the road trip with your friends to then later meeting up with your dad. There's just a lot for people who are, who have any sort of relationship with baseball to kind of latch onto it, because, you know, like, baseball is not just played on the field, but we play it in cul-de-sacs with friends. We play it on playgrounds with friends as kids. Many of us are introduced to the game through our dad. And so there just was like this natural, evolution to your story. But it was also like reading it going, gosh, this has been in how many hundreds of baseball writers' hands all along? Just a pack of baseball cards, and it's so genius that you had it. So that's why I want to use Lightning Bolt, because I want to pretend like it missed me all these years.
Also what you were saying was also why I opened and closed the book the way I did, which is with the factory workers at the Topps factory.
Yeah.
And I thought it was important to kind of zoom out and remind people that, you know, the heart of baseball is really not even the players. It's the bigger effect in the bigger community. And this is one of the take-home points of the book, is that, you know, it's the players themselves, what they miss more is not anything to do with baseball. It's their teammates, it's their camaraderie. And, you know, just watching those former Topps employees interact with each other in a casino in 2017, I could just sit back and the way that they interacted was the same, you know, looked the same as if you've had a bunch of former teammates sitting around telling their old stories. And that's the special part about baseball, right? Is that its ability to bring people together like that, whether you're the literally the person making the cards or you're the players on the field.
Yeah, that actually touches on something that we talk a lot about, you know, sometimes publicly, but a lot around the ballpark, is baseball losing some of its storytelling aspect? And what does that mean? You know, the Cardinals had a long time field coordinator in their minor leagues who has groomed managers and players, but he's also a fantastic storyteller, just tall tales, true tales, any kind of tales. And I kind of wrote a story about how he was the last of the storytellers walking out the room because, you know, as baseball has become larger business and more data driven.
Right, exactly. Well,
baseball writing is more about war and less about tales.
If you think about what are the books that are written about baseball nowadays, right? They tend to be these like very heavy on the analytics and the, you know, the breakthroughs in technology. And it's a little worrisome that there isn't more of that storytelling that's going on. And, you know, I agree with you that's, I don't know how much of that is also the players' personalities themselves nowadays. I mean, the guys in the wax pack would tell me that, you know, after a game, like 12 of them, 15 of them would go out to eat together.
Yeah.
And they would close down the bar and they would, you know, the bar would stay open for them. And I don't know. I mean, you would know better than I do if these guys would go out even in big groups anymore.
They don't, not all too much. And they don't sit around the clubhouse all that much, just swapping tails unless, you know, a lot of the relievers do, just because they have so much time together,
right?
Whether it's before or even during a game. And that's probably where you'll see a lot of those tails foster, maybe in the bullpen, and maybe some of the starters who aren't in the rotation anymore and are moving out to the bullpen. But the other part of it is players are getting younger and younger. You know, so there's less time for these stories.
Right. I mean, that's true. Like, how many of the over 35 grizzled veterans are even left, right?
Not very many. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't get contracts, and they kind of, their careers, like that was one thing about the Wax Pack players, was that
all
lot
10
of
years,
guys, you know, they held on and they had that kind of end of the line season, you know, and they're just kind of, they're there for their leadership in the clubhouse, and you don't see that nearly as much.
Well, what has been the reaction from the Wax Packers, the Wax Pack, the group of players to the book?
For the guys that I mean, I haven't heard from any of the guys that I didn't talk to.
Wow.
So I'm, you know, Carlton Fisk, who knows, he may not be too happy with me, but the guys that I did talk to, it's been wonderful. I mean, in fact, I think five of them, so Templeton, Mazzilli, Carmen, Mullenix, Kokenauer, we're all going to make appearances with me to promote the book.
Oh, great.
So, you know, hopefully that'll get rescheduled. But yeah.
Will the Templeton one be in St. Louis? That'd be fantastic.
No, actually, he lives in San Diego. So, yeah. But I was really happy that they thought highly enough to, you know, be willing to do that.
That's great. And I won't give it away, and people can buy and read the book but the Carlton Fisk chapter, particularly how you eventually
right,
broker a meeting with him, is excellent. having had to do that, not quite at that stage, never at that stage, but to try to get an interview, even when somebody least expect it, but they tell you so many ways they're not going to offer you an interview, I find fascinating because they just wasted so much time. But I've been in that in those shoes, just not at that big of a stage. So that was fascinating. And still no word from Coleman. That just is shocking. I'm surprised.
Well, yeah,
I thought Pettis for that matter. Actually, I'm a little surprised by Pettis.
Yeah, I guess I am too. Again, I didn't see Pettis really. I didn't see it being his choice. You know, he was told by AJ Hinch not to talk to the media.
Right. The Astros general manager, Jeff Luhnow, was big on that.
Right, right. So I should get a hold of his brother Stacy, who I did interview, and see, you know, just check in with him about it. But I thought it was really interesting. I wrote the epilogue last year, and so we had 4 years since the trip, and it was, I mean, you couldn't have scripted a better epilogue story with Coleman, right? Because for years he's like campaigning actively to get in the Cardinals Hall of Fame.
And he
finally does. I mean, I have no idea, but it almost seemed like the Cardinals were like, okay, fine.
I can offer some background on that because I actually serve on that committee.
Okay.
And that was, they call it the Red Ribbon Committee. And he was a fan vote. You know, that the fans
he got in through the fans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then he gives that speech and he basically just goes, I mean, he literally says, like, I'm here to promote myself.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I was there in the room.
And then, you know, he goes into the whole, like, basically asking for a job. And as far as I can tell, he has not gotten one from the Cardinals.
He has not. No, he has lobbied many, 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 many times to work for the Cardinals, to be a part of the Cardinals. And he talked a lot that weekend. To be honest, he talked a lot that weekend about being back in the family and being welcomed back into the family and how much it meant to him to be part of the family and to wear a red coat on opening day and know that he has an invitation. He was moved by it, I think partially because of the reunion with some of the players that he knows really well.
Yeah.
And also the honor of it. You know, the Hall of Fame has had some interesting things because, like, the Cardinals Hall of Fame has had a chance to honor McGuire at the end of all the stuff that he was not being voted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame and how much that meant to him. And then Ray Lankford, a player who was a great player at a down time for Cardinal baseball. And then, of course, Vince, a rather polarizing personality.
Right.
So this has been interesting. I appreciate all this time. I have one last question for you. Do you still open baseball cards? Do you still collect baseball cards?
You know, I don't go and buy them. When I was in, I actually was in spring training right before the COVID thing hit. And so
Arizona?
And I was actually there with my dad and we went around to a bunch. There's actually several baseball card shops that are still there in Phoenix. And I went and I actually bought several wax packs because one thing I wanted to do on the book tour was to, as like a giveaway, you know, like autograph a wax pack and give it to someone in the crowd. And so it was really cool to see that those shops still exist. And I did buy, like, I like when they do the cards for the current players with the old card designs, like the heritage card. So I bought some of those.
Favorite.
But I just don't see it as like a kid's industry anymore. You know, it seems like people that are really, it's still a thing and it's got a following, but it's more about the adult collectors. And I'll always associate it with more with my childhood.
Do you still feel like a kid opening a pack though?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think it brings me back because I would do that, you know, open the packs with my friends and we would trade the cards and we would get our price guides out. And so it just reminds me of that, all those times with my friends and the things we would do with our cards that, you know, it brings back those memories. So I always enjoy that.
Do you have a favorite card?
So my cards were in my mom's storage condo. And so a couple weeks ago, I decided to go out and get them. And so I didn't take all of them out, but I took out I had an album that I think I mentioned in the book where I had all those underdog players. I had all their cards.
Yeah.
And so I took that out and it was just great to see, you know, I would go to like card shops and have a list of players and everyone, they'd always be like, oh, you must be completing a set. And I'm like, no, I just really want to collect Marty Barrett and Spike Owen. And, you know, And they kind of give you this funny look. But I, sure enough, I have, you know, all these pages and sleeves of these players that were the underdogs that I liked as a kid.
That's fantastic. And this was during the quarantine time here that you did that?
Yeah, you know, it's right awesome. Here in my room. And I've thought about using that in some kind of, you know, just, I don't know, doing something with those cards now that this book is out and going back to them in some way. So I wanted to have them close at hand.
We're all doing a little quarantine cleaning, and I came upon a book that I had from 93, I believe, a little spiral bound book where I clipped box scores. All year long for the Yankees and charted their season and their rise and falls and had little notes about like hot streaks and cold streaks. And that one of the dominant pictures right there at the front of the book is of Spike Owen, like this action photo of him turning a double play. And I'll never forget that image because that was the one that I chose. This is the one that's going on the front, and I'm using it now because this is the season that I'm going to chart the Yankees back to greatness.
All right. That's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brett. Thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for the book. It's called The Wax Pack, and it's available on Amazon and at independent bookstores all throughout the country. I really appreciate you taking all this time to chat with me about Gary Templeton, about baseball cards, but mostly just about the notion of telling stories in baseball.
Thank you. It's been fun to chat, and I learned a lot myself just hearing your stories about working with Vince and all that. And so yeah. If you ever run into Vince, ask him if you ever saw the book. I'm curious what how angry he is with me.
I will. Whenever there's another spring training and he's hired by a team to work with them on base running, and I run around the entire complex looking for him because there's a rumor that he might be there.
Right.
If I ever actually catch him, I will definitely do that.
All right. Sounds good.
Special thanks to Brad Baluchian for joining the Best Podcast in Baseball to talk about his new book, The Wax Pack, On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife. You can find it anywhere you get your books, independent bookstores, Amazon. I was able to order it here in St. Louis from a local favorite independent bookstore and devoured it. I mean, quicker than the stick of gum would dissolve if it was inside it. It's just an excellent, compelling book, and I think you will find the chapter about Gary Templeton revelatory. Gives a new perspective on Templeton and about the event in St. Louis, but also what has happened since for him. And maybe it offers a little perspective, too, on what happened for the Cardinals after that time. Certainly that move brought on or helped bring on the greatness of the 1980s with one of the more charismatic teams the Cardinals have had. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball anywhere you get your podcasts, literally anywhere. I just checked. So anywhere you get podcasts, you should be able to find the Best Podcast in Baseball. If not, email me and I will correct that oversight. You can also find the Best Podcast in Baseball at stltoday.com, along with podcasts on the Blues and on Mizzou. My colleagues Dave Matter and Ben Fredrickson do the podcast on Mizzou. I hope to drag Ben Fredrickson back into the mix here shortly to be a part of this podcast, which has been back after its 1 week hiatus. You can also find our constant Cardinals coverage at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. It has been 50 days, remarkably, since the Cardinals last played a game. And yet, in this morning's paper, there were four brand new exclusive Cardinal stories and more to come during the day. Coming up in the days ahead, there's Rick Hummel with his Where Are They Now features that continue weekly. And in Sunday's paper, he caught up with Willie McGee. I think you'll enjoy that. Rick catching up with former players, current coaches, even umpires. There's a great story about Jerry Davis that Rick Hummel had in the paper. So please do visit stltoday.com, or if you subscribe, pick up the Post-Dispatch, find those stories therein. The Best Podcast in Baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball on iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes, or subscribe to the podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast. If you subscribe to the podcast, it makes sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make the podcast possible. You can also rate and review the podcast. I look forward to hearing from everybody about the quality of this lovely new mic that I have. Hopefully it's coming through. Hopefully you notice this was a goal of the past week. Let's say that. This was a goal of the past week, to improve the audio so that I could pull off these podcasts by remote, which are going to be the rule for a little while. Best Podcast in Baseball will be back weekly. With each passing week, we gain greater clarity as to how baseball might look in 2020. whether that's in the bubble plan that moves every team to Arizona, the hub plan that has teams collect around cities like Arlington, Phoenix, Tampa, or the Grapefruit League Cactus plan, or now the geographical silo plan, where they rewrite the divisions, throw all the teams in flyover country into one Midwest division, and let them duke it out to see who plays against the West Coast and the East Coast teams, who are similarly grouped by geography for what could be a 100-game, 110 season. Should be interesting. The best podcast in baseball will be there to cover it. Thank you very much for listening. For BPIB, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you next week.
It's every day, bro, with the math flow.
What are you working on?
Quadratic equations.
Okay, cool. Is it hard?
Yes.
Well, thank you for helping me test my microphone, son.
Yes. I will stay in the party chat.
Okay.
Bubbles came up. In the chat in case you need any more help with that microphone.
Okay, thank you very much for doing that.
Yes.
I think I almost got it figured out.
A question for you.
Yes, sir.
So say you had 6A, right?
Right.
And then you multiply it by 4A, that will give you 24A to the second.
Correct.
All right, cool. Very awesome.